Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on uniformitarianism when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. That's a scientific statement. It's true. Every year, the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. It's about 286,000 cubic miles of water pour into the oceans out of the rivers and streams every year. And for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. How's that all possible? Well, we call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide and begin their journey all over again. Now, in the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood and its laws are comprehended. Modern science today has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And this is one of the many lessons in the Mosaic Law School that we conduct twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on to the Archives page, and the Archives page holds that general law CD package. All right, we've been talking about this thing of uniformitarianism. There's a thing called uniformitarian geology. Well, uniformitarianism was thunk up by a guy by the name of Charles Lyell back in the, about 1830s, 1832, I think it was, and he wrote a book on the subject. And Charles Darwin was very impressed with the book. This is an era when people were thinking about something other than the Bible explanation for creation. And Lyell came up with this story of, or this theory of uniformitarianism. And just briefly, what you're looking at today is what's been going on forever. No changes. Now, our problem here is when we say no changes and what's going on today has always been going on in the past, we don't know that that's true. And the Bible tells us that there have been some catastrophes that have occurred in the past. And one of them, the big catastrophe, is this thing called Noah's flood. Now, there's two models out here. We've got the creation model, that's Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and then we've got the evolutionary model, which all of us were taught when we went to school, and they're selling the books. And today, if you try to bring up this creation model, immediately everyone says, oh my God, that's religion. No, hang on a second. A religion is something that you get from church, and that's those religious guys over there. They're peddling religion. The Bible doesn't peddle religion. The Bible is a science book. It's full of science. It's got science everywhere. I just read to you a story here. 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon made a scientific statement in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7. That's science. No religion involved there. Listen to this. It said, every year the continents and islands of the earth pour down into the oceans a volume of water of 286,000 cubic miles. And in Ecclesiastes 1, 7, it says, all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. And unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. That's a scientific statement, and it's true, accurate, and correct. It was true, accurate, and correct when Solomon made it, and it's true, accurate, and correct right now today. Right now today. Absolutely true science. And you can go demonstrate it. You can go down to the Amazon River, and you can watch the water run into the ocean. You can come up to the Table Bluff, and you can measure the ocean. You can see that that's a true statement. Now, evolution comes along and says, oh, no, you can't believe the Bible. That's a bunch of poppycock. And then the preachers come along and they say, oh, you can't believe the Bible. It's not a science book. Well, okay, you can believe what you want, but I just wanted to point out to you that the Bible is a science book and it's full of science. It's a history book and it's full of history. It's a prophetic book and it's full of prophecy. It's a law book and it's full of law. And I thought I would bring some of the science to bear here. And let's take a look at evolutionary philosophy along the lines of uniformitarianism. Now, a guy by the name of Morris came up with a plan. He wrote down a list of 70 scientific areas, such as things like atmospheric helium. We're coming to that. But I've already covered comets, the Big Bang Theory, thermodynamics, design, random chance. He took those, and then he applied the scripture, that is, the science and the Bible, and it works out perfectly. You can test it in the laboratory. You can go out there and you can look at it, weigh it, taste it, touch it, smell it, feel it. And then you can see it and understand it. Now you can apply uniformitarian philosophy to it, and it doesn't work. The numbers don't come out. And that's what I've been pointing out to you. When you apply the numbers to these scientific endeavors, these tests, it fails. Now here's another one here. Listen to this. You know, most of us have heard about the antiquity of the giant redwood trees in California. These massive living towers have grown up to more than 300 feet tall. Some of them were already 2,000 years old when Jesus ministered in ancient Galilee. But there are other plants alive today which date back even further than those redwood trees. The twisted and weather-beaten bristlecone pine trees cling stubbornly to life in one of the most hostile environments on planet Earth, where life can exist. In the White Mountains bordering California and Nevada, high in the arid desert, these rare and rugged trees have been growing for about 5,000 years. Their annual growth rings have been studied to give a reasonably accurate idea of their beginnings. Now, because of the hardiness of the bristlecone trees, it's fair to say that they will likely go on living for additional thousands of years, barring any catastrophe that would remove them. Now, the question then arises, logically, why don't we find a grove of trees somewhere in the world dating back to 8,000 years or 10 or 15,000 years? If trees like this have lived 5,000 years, they could have certainly lived longer. And it's almost as though all these trees were planted on a virgin earth just 5,000 years ago. And the Bible gives a clear historical record pointing to the global flood about 5,000 years ago, with the entire earth desolate, and it stands to reason why the trees of greatest longevity would date back only to that time and no further. Any of those trees that were living prior to the flood were destroyed and buried. These trees date back to around 5,000 years. Now, let's take a look at population. The population of the world, as I speak, is about 7 billion, a little under. When I started in about 1940, the population of the world was about 2.5 billion. So, in just 70 years now, the world has grown in population from 2.5 to about 7 billion people. That's a bunch. It's tripled in its size. Now, if we take those numbers and we extrapolate those back for a million years, and if we allow 40 years to a generation and we use a birth rate of about 2.5%, how many people should there be in the world today? Well, one of the most revealing clocks deals with the growth of the Earth's human population down through time. Dr. Henry Morris brilliantly addresses the subject in his book called Scientific Creationism, which is highly recommended. Consider the following facts. Dr. Morris has gathered these facts, and he said, think. If man has been on Earth for a million years, then why is the population explosion only recently becoming a problem? Today, worldwide, families average 3.6 children. The annual population grows at the rate of 2% per year. The present population would have been developed from a single family in just 4,000 years if the growth rate were reduced to only 0.5% per year, or about an average of only 2.5 children per family. Now that is a fourth of the present rate of growth. It could easily allow for long periods of no growth due to famines and wars. So what does the evolutionary framework have to offer? Well, with a supposed 1-million-year history of man, there should have been an incredible 25,000 generations at 40 years each, and even more incredible, the final total of people amounts to only the present population of under 7 billion. Now, does this fit the statistical facts? How big would the population be now if the population had increased 0.5% per annum for a million years? In other words, we would be insisting there be only 2.5 children per family for 25,000 consecutive generations. The resultant present population would be represented by the number 10 with 2,100 zeros after it. Now, obviously, that's impossible since tiny electrons numbering 10 with 130 zeros following it would fill the entire universe. So if a million years of man's history produced only the present population, how many people would have lived and died in all of that time? And the answer is, it would have been at least 3,000 billion, or 3 trillion. That's at least a couple of dozen graves for every acre on planet Earth. But ancient bones are extremely rare. Now, it seems that the facts line up directly with the biblical model and the acknowledged evidence that human culture can be verified back to less than 5,000 years ago, and that's the point of the global flood. The observable growth rate of human population on this planet fits much more naturally in the creation global flood framework than an evolutionary concept of uniformitarianism. Now let's take a look at the magnetic field. The phenomenon on Earth that makes directional compasses point to the north can tell us something about the Earth's age. And like everything else in the universe, the principle of progressive deterioration, which is called the second law of thermodynamics, is in operation here also. Physicist Thomas Barnes points out that the Earth's magnetic field has been decaying regularly since it was first measured in 1835. If the half-life of the field is truly what Dr. Barnes has shown from careful measurements, the conclusion is that the Earth's magnetic field would have been equal to that of a magnetic star as little as 10,000 years ago. And according to Dr. Barnes, to be consistent with the laws of physics, and assuming the magnetic field has continually weakened, we can only conclude that life on Earth would not have been possible more than 10,000 years ago. Now, last week I pointed that out. We were talking about that very thing there, the magnetic field. It has a half-life of 800 years. Every 800 years, the thing diminishes by 50%. Now, at some time in the distant past, all these menhirs and pyramids that we see around the world today were built, and it appears that they were built for tapping the ley lines and using that Earth's magnetic field to produce electricity. How they did that, we don't know, but we're pretty sure that that's about what they were doing. There had to be some reason for building 3,389 pyramids and building them along ley lines and building them in straight lines. But leaving that question aside, today, that magnetic field is necessary for human or biological life to exist on the planet. So there had to be a magnetic field, but it could not have been as strong as uniformitarianism would demand, since their claim to life is, or their claim to fame is, that what you see going on today has been going on forever. Well, then, if the half-life of the magnetic field has been going on forever, every 800 years, now let's go back a million years. Well, that thing would have to be, and I'm going to plug in 1 million here. There's 1 million divided by 800 years. 1,250 times stronger than it is today. Now, if we go back in time 6,000 years, and then we divide that by 800, it would have been 7.5 times stronger than it is today. Now, 7.5 times stronger than it is today, we can live with. Let's try another one. There are minerals in the ocean, and a worldwide erosion process continues. A wide variety of minerals have been dissolved and carried by rivers into the ocean. The densities of these dissolved minerals is slightly increasing every day. Now, because the amounts of these minerals can be measured in the river waters and then in the oceans, an equation can be calculated to give us an idea of how long it would take at present rates for these elements to reach their present densities in the ocean. So of all the minerals and compounds that we find in the seawater, none of their present concentrations require the assumed evolutionary age for the ocean. Remember, that was 1 billion to 2 billion years ago. Just give or take a billion. Now, the evidence does not suggest that the elements have precipitated out of solution. The only conclusion is that the oceans are relatively young. We do the same thing with sediment or silt going into the oceans. As you can see here, Henry Morris hit the nail right on the head. All you have to do is just take a look at the minerals in the ocean, or take a look at the magnetic field, or take a look at atmospheric helium. Let's try another one. In the atmosphere, we find helium. Helium, remember, it's a light gas used to fill balloons? Well, it is steadily gathering in the outer reaches of our atmosphere, and the total amount there can be measured. Now, one of the sources for helium is the constant measurable decay of uranium on planet Earth. If the Earth is billions of years old, the atmosphere would be saturated with helium to such a degree that there would be up to 1 million times more helium than we have now. You see where these numbers come in again? Shucks, kids. We can measure the rate at which helium is being created from the decay of uranium. We can see and measure how much is in the atmosphere. And then we can extrapolate it back, and here's what it tells us. With the amount of helium that's up there, 5,000 years fits right into the package, and it's no problem. When you go back here 1 million years, all of a sudden there should be a whole bunch more that isn't there. Now, some people have suggested that the helium must be escaping into outer space, but actually such escape is impossible. And the indication is that even more helium is being steadily added from the sun. And according to some experts, the helium clock insists that the Earth cannot be more than 10 to 15,000 years old. So again, you might argue and say, well, the Earth is 10,000 years old. I pointed out to you the other day, the chronology in Scripture says it's 6,034 years, you know, give or take 100. Hell, give or take 500. I don't believe for a moment that it is 10,000 or 15,000 years old. But hell, even if it was 10 or 15,000 years old, that's a young Earth. That's not millions, that's not billions of years ago. That's a few thousand years. Now, in our generation, when most people focus attention on the massive layers of mountain formations, they tend to automatically think of extreme age in terms of millions of years. It is necessary to remember that such thinking has its roots in the theory of evolution. Evolution is covered in more detail in section 2 of this book. Now, the familiar geologic chart of the history of the Earth was specifically designed with evolution in mind. Gradual processes of erosion and mountain building are supposed to have happened so slowly that only hundreds of millions of years could possibly account for all of it. So what formed the Earth's rock layers? Now, if you were to travel anywhere in the world to see the mountains and valleys that are exposed on the surface, you would commonly see three things. You'd see sedimentary layers of sandstone, and you'd see limestone and shale. They're found widely. They were clearly deposited by moving water. And these layers continue in every direction for many miles. Some of them are only inches thick, while others are many feet thick. For the most part, our entire Earth is overlaid by up to several miles of layer after layer of sedimentary rock. Secondly, volcanic rock layers also extend over much of the Earth. Often, they are interspersed among the sedimentary layers. And also, fossilized plants and animals are often found embedded in the Earth's layers, and virtually always in mass burials. So when you find fossils at all, you find jumbled piles of them. Now, would you expect the condition of their burial to tell us much about the events responsible for burying them? Or put another way, how does the Bible explain it? Well, according to the biblical record, the flood was a worldwide catastrophe lasting for more than a year. Over 200 non-biblical historical accounts from tribes and nations around the world also claimed the reality of this cataclysm. Now, with a massive upheaval, such as the flood described in the Bible, we would expect to see vast sedimentation on a global scale. Volcanism and fossilization are also evidences of rapid, catastrophic action. When you realize that a single local flood, volcanic eruption, or tidal wave can powerfully wipe out vast areas and redeposit sediment dozens of feet thick in just minutes, it becomes clear that enormous potential for destruction there is in a worldwide flood. Now, the rock layers, mountain upthrusts, and the many erosional features of Earth are easily accounted for by the flood. The problem with many people's thinking is that they make the flood too limited, when in fact it was the most awesome destruction that our planet has ever endured. The imaginary geologic chart, with its millions of years long, epochs, they call them, epochs, is totally meaningless if a worldwide flood really did happen. And after seeing the many evidences considered in this session, one fact becomes very apparent. The Earth is very young. Now, I guess we ought to take a look at what is science, anyway. These people claim to be science, they claim to be scientists, and they claim that their work is scientific. Well, the Oxford Dictionary defines science as a branch of study concerned either with a body of demonstrated truths or with observed facts, systematically classified under general laws, and which includes trustworthy methods for the discovery of new truth within its own domain. G.G. Simpson, a leading evolutionist, has said, "It is inherent in any definition of science that statements that cannot be checked by observation are not really about anything, or at the very least, they are not about science." Now, true science is observable. True science is demonstrable. And true science is repeatable. So we want to be able to repeat, demonstrate, and observe these phenomena. For instance, if we're going to look at the Big Bang, we need to be able to observe it, to demonstrate it, and repeat it. We can't do that. That's what makes it philosophy. The same thing is true with comets, or thermodynamics, or design, or random chance, or radiometric dating, juvenile water, erosion, topsoil, Niagara Falls, coral reefs, stalactites. We need to be able to repeat these observable demonstrations. Now, does science contradict the Bible? And some people believe that the scripture and God and his world are separate and possibly conflicting in apparent information. However, we should all keep in mind that the Word of God speaks unapologetically about the origin and operation of the natural world. The concept of creation was approved by Christ and the apostles who wrote the New Testament. Now, there are some science mysteries out there. Despite all of the work that has been done in all of the science disciplines, there are major enduring problems. What is electricity? What is light? What is gravity? Why do these phenomena behave so consistently? Now, some features of these things are known, but not to the basic why behind them. Now, many realms of science make being an authority in more than one realm impossible for most men. Scientists are real people, and they have the same human weaknesses and biases as non-scientists. Scientists who wish to be credible must be cautious not to make broad declarations on issues of religion or human spiritual matters in the name of science. So when scientists do say things about origins, supernatural powers and spiritual things, you should be careful to examine and challenge those theories. Theories are not facts. So what is a theory? Well, a theory is a guess. It's a suggestion that spawns inventive and logical research to explain some natural phenomenon. So have scientists been known to be wrong about these phenomena that they're observing? Well, false ideas in the name of science have been accepted in past generations only to be discarded by their descendants. For instance, the flat earth idea, or the idea that bloodletting is appropriate and that it is good medical procedure for reducing fever. The geocentric theory was the idea that the earth is the physical center of the universe. And phlogiston, P-H-L-O-G-I-S-T-O-N, phlogiston maybe, was believed by 17th and 18th century scientists to be the magical ingredient of all combustible things which enabled them to burn. Now the French chemist Lavoisier showed that oxygen was the key for fire and rapid oxidation to burn, not phlogiston. Now people have had ideas. They have to have a theory. Somebody, when you look at fire, trying to figure out, well, what causes that? What is it? How did they know back in 1800 that there was 21% oxygen in the atmosphere? Nobody had been able to isolate oxygen or hydrogen. So it takes time to accomplish the experimentation and then write it down and publish it. And then it's got to be tested by other people to find out, well, is this independently verifiable? You know, that's what science is about. It's, can we independently verify this on both sides of the Atlantic? So when it comes to fire, yep, we were able to do that. Now, scientists have made mistakes in the past. False ideas in the name of science have been accepted in past generations only to be discarded by their descendants. The flat earth idea. They called that science, you know, when they were talking about it. The idea that bloodletting is appropriate medical procedure for reducing fever. You know, when they were doing that, they believed it. The geocentric theory, the idea that the earth is the physical center of the universe. Well, it's a good theory, but it's just bad astronomy. And finally, phlogiston was believed by 17th and 18th century scientists to be the magical ingredient of all combustible things which enabled them to burn. The French chemist Lavoisier showed that oxygen was the key for fire, rapid oxidation to burn. Now, is evolution scientific? Well, no matter how you look at it, the theory of evolution must trace back to a point where inanimate matter became a living form. So look at the foundation of this theory. It says that unknown chemicals in the primordial past, through unknown processes which no longer exist, are produced, and then unknown life forms which are not to be found but could, through unknown reproduction methods, spawn new life in an unknown atmospheric composition, in an unknown ocean soup, at an unknown time and place. It was Dr. Henry Morris that wrote that little treatise. So is it any wonder, then, why many scientists, like Dr. Henry Morris, who proposed the above idea, insist that evolution does not even constitute a bona fide scientific theory? Henry Morris said, this thing isn't even a good scientific theory. And that's because it has been politicized. And the politics of it are such that we need to shut your mind off to God and the Creator. We can't have you thinking about, hey, maybe God has different plans here. We need to keep your mind off of God and onto materialism. And they've done a great job of that. They've succeeded at that. So the big question then, Bible-believing Christians are often mocked by those who say, prove your eternal God created all of this. But what is the alternative? Why not ask the scorner, can you prove to me that atoms are eternal? If God is not the creator, how did you get these atoms here? And this brings us then to the mysteries of evolution. For any creation or upward development, there are basically three things which are absolutely essential. There would have to be a program to direct the growth. There would have to be a mechanism to energize that growth, and the protection system, a protection system to sustain the growth. Now, does change equal evolution? You know, everyone who cares to investigate can see that change is constantly occurring in natural systems. Now, some call this microevolution, but let's realize that change is always limited within kinds, and the commonly held belief in evolution can be more specifically called macroevolution, which requires more than minuscule mutations to produce all of the different living kinds. Indeed, transmutation is the order of the philosophy. So we're asked to believe that cats change into dogs, and dogs change into horses, and monkeys change into people, and so on down the line. Now again, using Henry Morris's modality, when we actually go out and try to do this, it doesn't work. When we go out to observe it, where does this happen? Let's try this in our laboratory. We find that it doesn't occur that way. Now that should be a pretty good clue to us that this thing is as phony as a $3 Federal Reserve note. Okay, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk in the Law Hour website. It's updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. And these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to endorse and recommend the Law Hour. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about uniformitarianism, uniformitarian geology. Uniformity is the rule, or the modern rule, that is alleged to be scientific, but yet when we test it, and remember so far we've looked at the Big Bang, comets, thermodynamics, design, random chance, radiometric dating, juvenile water, erosion, topsoil, Niagara Falls, coral reefs, stalactites, igneous crystal buildup, what's the oldest living thing around, population studies, the magnetic field, dissolved minerals in the ocean, atmospheric helium. You know, each and every one of these, and we're just touching the tip of the iceberg. Henry Morris put 70 of those together, tested them all. I just took a handful of them and said, hey, let's run this one by everybody and see what this shows us. Now, Henry Morris wrote a book called The Genesis Flood. He's around. Do a Google search on Henry Morris, The Genesis Flood. And there was another book here mentioned by Morris. There's quite a bit of them here. Morris referenced. This guy Morris has written more books than you can shake a stick at. And he is a hydrologist, Henry Morris says. And he's written a bunch of good books on creation and creation science. I think you'll enjoy them. I've put them to the test. His stories, his logic, at least makes sense. These evolutionary models over here, even the arithmetic fails. These guys haven't even got the numbers straight, for crying out loud. You know, at least when you go to check something out, you know, the numbers ought to add up. 2 and 2 is 4, 4 and 4 is 8. You know, we've been putting the numbers to this uniformitarianism here time after time after time. When the numbers don't add up, that should tell you quite a little story right there. Now, what are the roots of this evolutionary philosophy? We ought to know this, first of all, that in the last days, this is a citation now from 2 Peter 3, verse 4. Know this, first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. That's uniformitarianism. All continues just as it was from the beginning of the creation. Write that down. That's 2 Peter 3, verse 4. You talk about a prophecy having come to pass. And these guys mock. They kind of laugh. They're condescending. Pat you on your little pointed head and say, oh, you poor ignorant savage, dragging your knuckles on the ground. Now, until the mid-1800s, brilliant scientists had no trouble accepting the biblical account of creation. Remember Isaac Newton and other familiar names such as Kepler, Faraday, Kelvin, Mendel, Lister, and Pasteur, all of them, believed in the creation account. So what happened? They all died with faith in God, but a new generation arose in the midst of much skepticism and moral decline in society, and uniformitarianism was born. Charles Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology, and he published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. And it was literally, or it has literally, shaken the intellectual world. The study of Earth's geophysical structures was an infant science then, but now his concepts are so widely accepted that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated. So, now I'm telling you. The guy's name is Charles Lyell. Now, Lyell's basic premise has been adopted by all scientific fields, even though his field of study was Earth science, or geology. He proposed that all of our Earth's features can be explained in terms of present observable processes which supposedly have always gone on in the past. So when we look at the Grand Canyon and we observe the Colorado River running through it, we're supposed to believe that what we're looking at today has always gone on in the past. Well, if there was a great flood, which is what we're postulating here, well then, what we're seeing today hasn't always gone on in the past. There was a catastrophe. And you see, these guys, now, they're telling you that there's no catastrophes, no special creation. There isn't any God out there that's big enough to do all this. Now, I don't know how big this God is. I don't know if he's 6 foot tall or 66 feet tall. And, you know, somebody comes along and they say, well, I don't believe that he could create all of this. Hell, I can't create a 747, but now that I see those 747s flying around, and I can remember the first time I ever saw one, I flew into Seattle, Tacoma, and I was down at the end of the runway waiting for takeoff instructions, and I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and pretty soon something started to appear coming down out of the clouds, and I saw the biggest thing I'd ever seen in my life. This is about 1970, probably. Those 747s just came out, I think, in 1968. Oh, I'd seen pictures and I'd heard the stories, but, you know, I never saw one of them until I was at SeaTac. And I'm sitting here at the end of the runway, and this thing looks like it's flying about 10, 15 miles an hour, descending out of the clouds, coming in for a landing. And when that thing went right in front of me, I looked at that and I said, my God, that thing can't possibly fly. It's like a bumblebee, you know. They used to say, a bumblebee cannot fly. Aerodynamically, it just can't fly, but, you know, they do all the time. And that 747, it flies. Now, what I believe, or what my limited concepts and understandings are, doesn't change anything. I can't design and build one of those, but I can see the results of other people who have greater talent and ability than I have. Now, how do you and I know how much talent and ability this creator has? I mean, he makes some pretty wild statements, I gotta admit. You know, when somebody says, I'm without beginning and I'm without end, that's quite a statement. I can't contradict the guy because I don't even know him. Now let's take another one. You know, he says, of all the stars and the planets that are out there, what we do is we number them. Then we have constellations and we name them, and then we number the stars if we can in there. And there's thousands and thousands. In fact, they tell us, and I just heard this the other day from Kent Hovind, he said, it's now estimated that there are 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. Now observable, that's the Hubble telescope observable universe, 12.5 billion light years out. 2 trillion. Well, our Milky Way galaxy is 100 million miles across, and there's 2 trillion of those? And our galaxy contains billions of stars, presumably billions of planets and comets and asteroids and all kinds of other space matter out there. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff out there. Now listen to this guy. He comes along and he says, I know them all by name. He made another wild statement. He said, I know every hair on your head. My God, there's 7 billion people in the world. And this guy comes along and says he knows every hair on your head, my head, everybody else's. I didn't know that anybody even cared how many hairs were on your head. I'll probably fool him a little bit because mine keep falling out. And unless he's keeping up with my hair and it's falling out, he might get stumped. But here are these statements that are being made. Now, the average Joe Sixpack, we cannot count the hairs on anybody's head, not even with a calculator. We can't get the job done. Secondly, we do not know how many stars there are, much less name them. And all of us have a beginning and we all have an end and we all know that. And we don't know of anybody or anything that has always existed, and that includes the little dot at the end of the sentence from which all the mass and matter in the world exploded from, remember, or is descended from because of the great Big Bang explosion. We don't know of anybody like that. So when this guy comes along and he makes statements like that, you know, it's understandable that some guys would probably, what? Let's be a little bit more reasonable. Now, I can't tell you that this guy cannot name all of the stars in the heavens. I don't know whether he can or not. He says he can. And I don't know of anybody out there that knows that he can't. I know there's a lot of guys out there that don't believe that he can, but just because you don't believe it doesn't mean it isn't true. Hey, listen, just because some guy in a Stone Age culture down in Borneo with a bone sticking through his nose doesn't believe that big machines like 747s can fly doesn't change anything. Ignorance doesn't change anything. And we don't get wisdom and we don't get knowledge from ignorance. So just running around saying, I don't believe it, doesn't cut the mustard. Come on, let's grow up and wake up here and smell a coffee. Now notice that from his system of reasoning, a doctrine of origins was designed by simply projecting all of the natural processes back through time indefinitely in catastrophes like the flood then can be strictly ruled out. And that's what they want to do, is rule out this flood. Now Charles Darwin, in our time, the word evolution and Darwin are almost inseparable. At the age of 22 in 1831 with a basic degree in theology, Darwin, now he was a preacher. Charles Darwin began a five-year world voyage as the naturalist aboard the ship Beagle. He read Lyell's book and began gearing his concepts of biological origins according to the uniformitarian philosophy. Darwin's dogmas of the evolution of species could never have gotten off the ground without Lyell's gift of billions of years. Thus, the foundation was laid for what came to be known as Darwinian evolution. And though the theory of evolution, or though that theory of evolution and even the idea of natural selection were not original to Darwin in his book, The Origin of Species, which was published back in 1859, and that quickly exalted him to fame. He became the central figure of evolutionary thinking in a world filled with revolution, human and humanist attitudes and spiraling social upheaval. Now, gradualism comes into the lexicon about this point. The word gradualism is often used in place of uniformitarianism, since the intended meaning is the same. Slow processes, gradually going on through immense spans of time, are assumed to be the only cause for virtually everything in nature and in the universe. Now, a working definition of evolution is a directional and essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and an increasingly high level of organization in its products. Our present knowledge, indeed, forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. That's a citation that comes from a guy named Julian Huxley. And then the evolutionary tree of life comes into the picture here. Most school children today are familiar with the typical diagram depicting how all forms of life supposedly evolved through the last 2,000 million years. 2,000 million, that's 2,000 million, that's 2 billion. This chart, wait a minute, 2,000 million. Yeah, 2 billion. This chart is usually published with no explanation that it is purely a theory with no evidence to substantiate it. So there's a diagram here, and I'm looking at a starfish, I think, down here at the bottom. And then I'm looking at toads and lizards and birds and trilobites and horses, and, you know, and up it goes. And pretty soon, oh, here's man. He's up here at the top. There he is right there. And here's the monkey right below that, and there's a raccoon right below that. There's the horse. This is called transmutation. Now, this creator that we were just talking about here a minute ago, he says, kind reproduces after kind. Dogs produce dogs. Cats produce cats. You can't get a cat out of a dog, and you can't breed a cat with a dog. And the reason, now, you know, we're getting smarter now today, and it's the genetic code. It's the DNA. We can see why it is. There's just so many genes, and those genes have to match up. And I saw one the other day. I think it's the fern. It has 436 genes to it. Human being, or chromosomes, I guess it is. It's 436 chromosomes. And humans have 46 or 48, something like that. And I wondered about that. I said, now, how come a fern, a lowly fern out here in the forest, has more chromosomes than a human being? You know, it seemed like to me that if you were going from the simple to the complex, wouldn't you have, you know, a fern down here at the bottom with 46 and man at the top with 400? I mean, aren't we more complex than a fern? Then, if there's no evidence, then why believe the theory? Well, many scientists have faced the reality that the subject of origins comes down to a personal choice of opinion. The statement of S.A. Keith may help clarify the issue. He said, evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it, evolution, because it's the only alternative to special creation, and that's unthinkable. Now, the reason that we want to believe in evolution is because we do not want to obey God. We absolutely refuse. We're just all sitting out here saying, no way, Jose, are we going to practice these Ten Commandments and practice this law of God. The religious guys, they do it in their way. They simply say the law is abolished, nailed to the cross with Jesus, and we got a license to do whatever the hell we want to. The evolutionary guy, he comes along and says, well, we don't like religion either, so we're going to reject the Pope, and then we're going to reject God and the Bible. And then that leaves something called evolution for us to believe in. So on the one hand, the Pope doesn't want to obey God, and of course the people don't want to obey the Pope. And so that's what leaves us then with evolution, doesn't it? Now, there's a thing here called spontaneous generation. With random processes in time, the raw elements of the earth eventually became living organisms. This widely held belief is called spontaneous generation. Now, have you seen the pictures used to try to impress you with what some feel represents reality? So they got a picture here with a volcano blowing up, the sun is shining, and then they've got the ocean here and rocks, and then they've got DNA, and then they've got little cells over here, and here comes spontaneous generation. Now listen, if spontaneous generation and evolution work, then we should be able to document that in the laboratory. We should be able to go pick up some primordial soup and stick it in a Petri dish, stick a little heat under it like a Frankenstein movie, and then put a little heat to it and see if we can't come up with some spontaneous generation. It ain't going on today, hasn't gone on in the past, and ain't going to in the future. Nobody can demonstrate it. They believe in it, but we can't demonstrate it, can't replicate it. That, boys and girls, again, is philosophy. That's not science. Now, a common description of how the thinking goes, the following quote is taken from a book by Benjamin Bova called The Giants of the Animal World. Carefully notice the wording and the implications of his statement. It's quite typical of explanation given about the first or how the first life came to be. The Earth was born about 5 billion years ago, and scientists are not certain of just how it happened, but they believe that life began about 2 billion years ago in the shallow waters of some unknown seacoast. A group of atoms came together in a very certain way. They formed a new type of molecule, a giant molecule, much bigger than all the other atom groups nearby, and this large molecule could do something that no other molecule could do. It was able to take simple atoms and smaller molecules from the sea and make a new giant molecule just like itself. Once upon a time, far, far away, there was a dot at the end of the sentence. And then it was so heavy and it was so compact that it exploded and blew up, and all that we see today comes from that dot. And with that, I'll have to leave it, and we'll take it up there next time. Let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.